Les colloques du Collège de France.
Alors nous allons continuer notre parcours à travers les sciences cognitives et les neurosciences de la musique et aller jusqu'à l'éducation. Nous avons la très grande joie d'accueillir aujourd'hui Nina Kraus. I'll switch to English. She'll be speaking in English. Nina Kraus is one of these extraordinary researchers who has been pursuing the topic of today for her entire career. She's professor of communication sciences, neurobiology, and otorhinolaryngology at Northwestern University in the US, and she crossed the Atlantic specifically for this talk, so thank you, Nina. She's also the author of a great book, which is called Of Sound Minds, How Our Brain Constructs a Meaningful Sonic Word. She is specialized in particular in the early aspects of music perception, and she's going to talk about the argument for music education. So, Nina.
Thank you so much. And I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to everyone here. And let's get going. Okay, the argument for music education. So when my grandbaby was born, he had some difficulty breathing. And my son, I'm really getting a lot of sibilants. And my son, who you see in this picture, sang to him, and immediately he said he could just feel his baby relax and his vital signs stabilized. He was in intensive care. You can see the monitor there, and it told the tale in numbers. And here's me talking to my other grandbaby in Italian, and look at how interested he is in what I have to say. And you know, we are tuned into sound, and this begins in utero. So importantly, and as you've heard today, the hearing brain is vast. It's not just the classic auditory pathway. And so it really does, our hearing brain inherently engages our feelings, our viscera, how we think, what we know, our memory, how we move, how we combine our other senses. This is what the hearing brain does. The hearing brain is vast. Now, you're going to hear some noise, and tell me if you hear any words. Any words? So the sentence in there is this.
The juice of lemons makes fine punch.
Now I'm going to play the first again. So do you believe me that what we know about sound influences how we hear it? This is a very vast interconnected system. And music, of course, music is the jackpot of engaging all of these systems. So sound is invisible, and sound is composed of various ingredients like pitch and timing, timbre, phase, of course, you all know that. And I like to use the metaphor of these ingredients entering the brain, and I can think of the brain as a mixing board where the faders on the mixing board can tell us how good you are at processing phase, how good you are at processing pitch. And we can have a good idea of people's strengths and bottlenecks. And we do this with a particular physiologic response. Of course, as I'm talking to you now, the neurons in your brain are producing electricity, which we capture. And we capture the frequency following response, which enables us then to, it informs us, how good a job is this boy doing at processing the different ingredients of sound. Now, a sound we use a lot is the mighty da. It occurs in almost all of the world's languages. It has a consonant, a vowel. It has a lot of timing, including onsets. And it has a fundamental frequency, very important for pitch and determining who or what is making the sound. It has harmonics, important not just for distinguishing instruments, but for distinguishing what consonant or vowel was spoken. And it has a trajectory of changing pitch in time, FM sweeps. Now, you will be hearing from my ambassador from time to time, and here he is.
Da-da.
Da-da.
Da-da-da.
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 So we can also listen to the brain. So finally, we have science meets art. Here is the brain keyboard. And we have recorded the brain's response to every note on the keyboard. Can you play a couple notes for us? So this is the brain's response to individual notes. And now you will hear Mark Meadows play the brain. Thank you.
So
we have a lot to work with. We can look at groups of people, we can look at individuals, and actually hear their brain response to sound. And we are having a workshop on the frequency following response in Chicago in just a few weeks. So if you're interested, you can find it, I'm sure. So over the years, we have recorded brain responses from thousands of people who we call musicians, which are anybody who makes music on a regular basis. And we do this from womb to tomb. Are you sure this sound is okay? Because I can pick, yeah? All right. This is about sound. It has to be right. One of the things that we've discovered with respect to the sound ingredients is that people who make music have enhanced brain responses automatically over time, enhanced brain responses to the harmonics, to the FM sweeps, and to timing ingredients. And this is really important because music and language ingredients overlap. So a child who is good at reading and has good language skills will have faders will be very high, whereas a child who has a language problem will have a lower fader. For emotion, we need these ingredients to understand emotion. If we have a baby crying, right? We have to be able to interpret, do I get up now and go to my baby in the middle of the night when he's crying? Or is it better for both of us if I let him cry for a while and then we'll both have a better day the next day? But I have to be able to interpret that, and the musicians can do this because the important information, the information that tells you whether he means it or not, is here in the harmonics. So hearing a noise, as promised by Robert, this is some of Robert's scanning and some of our physiologic responses. Musicians, in fact, are very good at processing speech in quiet and in noise, and non-musicians, on the other hand, do a good job in non-challenging environments, so in quiet, but you can see that the responses really fall apart in noise. Rhythm is important. So he wasn't walking yet, he just went up to the radio and one morning did this. So we know there is a lot of research linking rhythm and language skills. So this is the very best way to develop rhythm skills is to do these kinds of rhythm activities. You can do them in your home. In our lab, we have measured rhythm abilities and brain responses to different ingredients of sound in the same child. And one of the things that we have discovered is that the children who can synchronize well to rhythms and who are good at rhythm ability have brain responses that are also more rhythmic. Of course, there are many rhythms in speech. And the very important thing is that the synchronizers, or the children with good rhythm abilities and whose brain's responses synchronize to the rhythms of sound, they have better language skills. Now, we did work also in Los Angeles with the elementary schools and in Chicago schools in just, this was high school, so this is learning music later in life, and in low-income neighborhoods, and the best students. Okay, so the founders of these two music programs came to me and they said, you know, the teachers already know that the students who make music are the better students academically. We know this already. Every teacher knows this. But what is going on in their brains? And so we began longitudinal studies. And I know this myself. I've been now for many years teaching a class called Biological Foundations of Speech and Music. And I have undergraduates from many different fields, you know, from linguistics, from history, from engineering. And it's so easy for me to pick out the music students. The music students are always just the best students. So we matched the children ahead of time. One group of children had music instruction, again, of the kind of frequency that Asal was talking about, considerable over every week. And another group had a different form of enrichment activity. And so I want you to hear. Listen to the brain's response of a child who is enjoying a music education. Now here is his classmate who is not having a music education. I think you can hear the difference, and we can certainly precisely measure the differences. We also know that there is a biological signature of poverty. We know that children who grow up in poverty, their representation of the ingredients of sound is diminished, especially these important ingredients that we need for language. In addition, they have more neural noise. So, you know, our brain, you know, the currency of our nervous system is electricity, and our brain is always on. And there is more unsynchronized, noisy activity. Think of the static. There is more static in the brains of the children who grow up in poverty. And we wondered, so you know, you can kind of think of this static. We wondered whether, so this diminished representation of these sound ingredients and the noise, whether that would change, if music could help offset that. And what we didn't see any difference, any change in the neural noise that still remained high, but we saw very pronounced improvements in the encoding of these important sound ingredients. And it takes time, and we're talking about fundamental changes in the brain, you know, being able to really fundamentally process, make sense of sound. This took at least in our hands, both in high school and in the elementary school, it took 2 years And so we followed these kids for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And also, importantly, it has a lifelong impact. We have done other studies where we have found that people who have had a musical education at some time in their life and then they stop, this reaps benefits even when they're 70, 80 years old, their processing of sound. Once you have learned and your nervous system has fundamentally changed and you have learned to make sound to meaning connections, this stays with you throughout your life. So a music education is important for children and it is important for us throughout our lives as we get older. Often with aging, the neural response to sound becomes diminished and noisier and less precise. But a person who, certainly if they continue to make music and if they have made music in the past, it is pretty indistinguishable from that of a younger person. So our life in sound shapes our brain, and it's very important. We have a responsibility. This is what this conference is all about. We have a responsibility to make the right choices for health and for our nervous system. So, importantly, sound connects us. Ah! Now, we also know that there is brain synchrony when people listen together. So particular parts of the brains that have been talked about are active because we synchronize together when we are making music together.
The research team found that the duo's brainwaves synchronize when they play a duet together.
Sie hören das Metronom viermal, setzen dann zusammen ein, spielen einmal durch und warten dann.
Sänger now wants to know whether the waves also oscillate in tandem when Viola Weise and Duncan Taylor are playing different parts. In this scenario, their two brains have to coordinate continuously. Duncan plays the introductory bars. Even before the two-part section of the piece begins, his brain waves are oscillating in tandem with Viola's. A spectacular result.
So, this brain synchrony also occurs with musicians and their audience. So, it's really true that music connects us, and it connects us fundamentally, biologically. So, we need frameworks to think about this. We think about the biology of learning. So my grandson is making sound to meaning connections.
Wow!
It's the first time he made the harmonica go. He's so happy.
Beautiful.
So, you know, we are always asked, where in the brain is this happening? And as often happens, I take my inspiration from music, and the Beatles have told me, here, there, and everywhere. So, I have this beams hypothesis. This is beams light, and then I will give you the actual thing. But before we've learned something, we don't even know what we don't know. As we begin to learn whatever it is that we're learning, we realize how much we don't know. And then we begin to be conscious of the different elements and the different things that we need to know in order to get some expertise. And eventually we learn and we play unconsciously, and we have learned it deeply. So my beams hypothesis is, well, remember, the hearing brain is vast. So emotion, motor, combining our senses, what we think, what we know, our viscera. The B in brain is, the B is for brain. Experience changes the sonic brain. And the efferent pathway, which is the pathway that goes from this vast hearing brain down all the way down to our ears, and this is changeable, and it is under conscious control. Eventually, it turns into an automatic response that the ear-to-brain pathway automatically will send signals that you have learned are important. So, for example, if you are sound asleep, and I have electrodes on your head, and I say the sound of your name, your brain will respond because you have learned that this is something that is important to pay attention to. And what is this? So B-E-A-M, our memory for sound. What are we if not our memories? So I don't think we any longer need to argue about music education. We know what to do. There are so many studies, and books have been written. And I want to put to you this idea, you know, we talk in learning about near and far transfer. Does music transfer to other activities? Well, it makes no sense to talk about how music education transfers to memory, emotion, cognition. Remember, the hearing brain is vast. What we learn from music doesn't transfer to other parts of our lives. They are these other parts. Evelyn Glennie, a deaf musician, says, honestly, I don't understand why we must persuade people about the benefits of music. This should be just as natural as the food we eat, as the air we breathe, as having a bed to sleep in. Music is a way of life, and you don't have to be an expert. I think this is very important to understand. So this is the baby you saw in intensive care on my very first slide. This is his first time on drums. He knows just what to do. This is my other ambassador. So you don't have to be an expert. You make this a way of life. Now, the other thing that I think is very important is how we teach music. And music, so, you know, in the thousands of people who have come into my lab and that we have studied, we give them a questionnaire and we ask them, how do you learn music? Is it by notes or by listening? And they fall into two camps, one or the other. There are very few people who I would call musically bilingual. We should change that. We should change how we are educating our children because we're losing out on a very important opportunity. You know, we can also think in terms of chords, right? And improvisation. This is such a vast system to be working with. So I think we should think about teaching music more holistically and understand these biological bases better, but we already have a pretty good idea. I'm just giving you an example about rhythm. You can learn rhythm by looking at the notes, or you can listen. So these involve different processes, and they should be done simultaneously. So this is the rhythm, and it's a tough one. It's in 17-16 timing. It's from a song called Thumb Hang about the Inquisition. And you can see this very complex pattern that the drum plays, and then you just listen to it. It happens four times. Once. Okay, and it's quite a different experience if you're counting one E and a two E and a, and you know, hearing it. But they both have, they're both part of the system. So I want to leave you with just a few ideas about a way forward. As scientists, we must be science's greatest critics and acknowledge science's limitations. Still, it is our responsibility to interpret existing evidence and come up with the best way forward. And there's lots of existing evidence. I am not debating whether music is the only way or even the best way to achieve meaningful educational benefits. We already have good evidence that music is a way. While methods of education and the stuff of life itself is ever more technologized, there is an ever more urgent need for our children to learn music. Music humanizes us. If we can agree that what we do changes us biologically, we must strive to become more than the machines we engage with. It is crucial for child development to foster focus, discipline, and social engagement. These intangible, difficult to measure benefits of music education move us towards what I think is education's goal, namely the formation of responsible members of society. So I put to you that we know what to do, and it is based on the available evidence that science can bring us. We need to implement music education as broadly as possible, and we need to teach music more holistically. So it takes a community to do our work. These are the alumni who have gotten their PhD in our lab. We have an education community, we have a music community, we have a clinical community, we have an athletic community. And these are the people in our lab at the moment. And this is Katie Shelley, who has done a lot of the illustrations, and she is responsible for the 80 original illustrations in my book, which is conversationally written for you. It's my love letter to sound. And this is the homepage of our website, which I hope you will visit. Again, it is for you. We have a little tour. If you press the tour bus icon, in a few minutes, you will get a video that will help you find what you're looking for because the website is vast. And our work, 100% of our work, is supported by outside sources. And I hope, if you would like to help us, please do, because these outside sources, and it is people like you who bring our work, make it possible. And I think I am done.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.